But I will take one just to start out by saying that this is a short course that designed around discussing several, actually a variety of topics and points of view in mathematics that is motivated by problems in fluid dynamics, very traditional source of good problems in fluids. And the first person we thought of when we designed the short course was to invite Charles Fefferman, who is a great mathematician and also has been working on fluid dynamics, in fact, the Navier-Stokes equation, in the last several years with his students and associates. Unfortunately, effectively at the last minute, he had to cancel for personal reasons. And so I thought I would, and then somebody had to speak, otherwise there'd be a little bit of a gap. Can't leave. Nature abhors a vacuum. So I volunteered to give one talk in place of Fefferman's three, and I thought I'd talk about a result of his. So my title, as you see here for today, is On the Theorem of Cordoba, Fefferman, and de la Llave. Okay? I'm still worried that I'm starting without one of the principal hosts, because Kathleen is not here yet, but maybe she just forgot. So maybe I should just start. Shall I just be, sorry? Maybe she thinks it's 210, which is a University of Toronto tradition. Well, let's cure her of that by starting henceforth, and she'll have to sneak in late. So I want to talk about the following equations. So my section one is equations. So really, these are questions which have a certain mathematical pedigree, and so I want to talk about things like the Euler equations. Actually, I don't want to put that down first. I want to say these have a mathematical pedigree, and they describe fluids and have and the description has actually originally written down probably in the I'm going to show my poor handling of history probably in the mid 19th century. Who's a historian who can correct me? Euler lived before then, but I think it was after him they named Euler's equation. Costas.
I don't know if he named them Euler's
20th century name on a 19th century, 19th century equation named after an 18th century mathematician. It's probably that. That's what I suspect. Maybe it's best to say that all the flows I'm going to talk about today, there are going to be vector fields u of x, t. X is going to sit in some r, d. D plays an essential role, and where D will vary, and they will change in time. T will be an R or maybe R plus. So let's move forward, and we'll always have T and R plus. And they're all, at least the ones in the subject matter of today's talk, are going to be incompressible. So that says that this vector field satisfies the following. It may have D components, but it satisfies at least one equation, which is the divergence is equal to zero. And then it has a flow. So since u of x, t depends on x and t, I start at a point x, and I flow. Let me say this. I start at a point x, and I flow by time t, and it gives me another point. So the picture is here's space. This is x1 up to x2. And here I start with x. And then I follow the vector field, the particle has a trajectory, and this arrives at phi t of x. But it's not an autonomous flow. The vector field depends on time. So what I want to do is change the notation a little bit, starting at time s and arriving at time t. This is a point x at time s, and I arrive at t, and I arrive at that point y at time t. If it were autonomous, phi would only depend on t minus s. Here it depends on t and s explicitly. Okay? And this is divergence-free. It means I'm going to call that equation D, which means that the flow has the property, despite the fact it's moving things and despite the fact that it's changing in time, it still never changes volume. Never changes volumes. Okay? Comment one. So this is interesting in 2 and 3 and 4 dimensions. If I set D equals 1, we have already a problem with this constraint, as there are not very many incompressible vector fields in D equals 1. So let's just make that comment. D equals 1, U equals constant is the only... I mean, if I take this seriously, it says it has to be the derivative has to be 0. So U equals constant is the only only function satisfying D. So in the search of one-dimensional analogies, you might have to change that condition. Well, let's go on to the more famous equations, which is Euler flow. So these are the Euler equations. I want U to satisfy other equations as well. So these are the famous Euler equations, D by dt U plus U dot grad U is equal to not zero, but the gradient of a function. And again, I'm just looking at all of R, D, and T, and R plus. Okay, and then there's the famous, that's the famous Euler equation, and the famous Navier-Stokes equations, which is very similar. D by dt U plus U dot grad U is equal to minus the gradient of a function, known as the pressure, plus Laplacian of U, and actually often there's a nu there, so 1 upon the Reynolds number is nu, and that's related to viscosity being in the picture. So let's make this comment again. Comment. Oh, and the idea is that I'm interested in studying the formation of singularities or the lack of singularities in the flow of these equations. And it's a big problem. Maybe it was a little problem until people learned it got hard, and people tried harder, and it got harder. So it's now become a big problem, and in fact, it's a Clay Prize problem. So this has now achieved the status of a Clay Prize problem, which is not to say that I'm going to get the Clay Prize for giving this talk. In fact, I'm talking about Cordoba-Pfefferman and De La Llave, and they're maybe closer, but still haven't achieved it. So anyway, it's a Clay Prize problem. I don't know which one, actually. So let's go back. So let's see about singularities, what happens just by saying, how about D equals 1 again? Just a comment. So D equals 1. Let's dump incompressibility and the two most natural, and just write down the two most natural analogies. So let's say Euler in one dimension is going to be, I look for a function U, D by dt U, plus U d by dx U equals, probably just set it equals 0. And this has singularities for almost all data. This has singularities are common. And then let's, how about the Navier-Stokes equation in one dimension? So I'm just showing that d equals 1 is a little special. And that's d by dt u plus u dx u is equal to, I'm just forgetting the pressure, nu times dx squared u, and solutions are smooth. So there we've answered the question in one dimension, although I haven't told you why. But, and there are bigger experts than me in the audience, so in any case. I want to also talk about a third system. So the third system was derived by Boussinesq. So this is a Boussinesq system. And that looks just slightly different. Actually, it's slightly augmented from that. It's a d by dt, u. Again, I have u, a divergence-free vector field, which also satisfies these equations, plus u dot grad u equals minus the gradient of a pressure plus a viscosity times Laplacian u plus a vector which is 0 in the first N, first D prime components, and then a theta in the Dth component. So this is the Dth component. And these are the D minus 1 first components. And there's an equation also for theta, which is dt theta plus u dot grad, so theta is that vector, plus a different coefficient of diffusion, Laplacian theta. And Boussinesq introduced this, I believe, to model a thin and, in any case, layered atmosphere. I don't know. This is the same Boussinesq person, but not the same Boussinesq equation as it comes up in dispersive water waves. So I know it's a joke about Boussinesq, but I'm going to tell that at T to keep myself from wasting too much time in the lecture. And I think theta has something to do with something which will create a buoyancy force. But again, I'm not a perfect expert. There's actually a book on the Boussinesq system by the famous Chandrasekhar. So there's S. Chandrasekhar. Wrote about it. And again, there's a question of regularity of solutions. Emphasize theta as a scalar and u as a d vector. So as we're talking about the Clay Prize problem, Moffat had his own list of prize problems. I think they're a little bit more focused on his own interests, but he said this is one of his 21st century problems to discuss singularities. And he was actually interested in the case of D equals 2, and in fact even more specific singularities, which I'll talk about in a little while. But the paper that I'm presenting gives an answer to the negative, to his question on formation of singularity. So let's see. I want to now make a list of my favorite theorems in the subject. Those are the equations. Here's my section 2, which is, I should say, results, or maybe my favorite theorems. At least as it pertains to the particular question at hand of an incompressible flow and the question of are singularities formed or not. So the first one I still think is a leading light. It's one of these papers that everyone cites and very few people read in detail. Is the following. It concerns the Hausdorff dimension of the singular set. This is a result of Cuffarelli, Cohen, and Nierenberg. Published in 1982. And I think it's a beautiful work that we should read more studiously. And let's see, it says the following thing. Because of time, I really cannot go into detail on this in any case, but at least I can make a statement. So I'm going to say a point x0, t0 is in the singular set. So this singular set is a subset of R. And this is for an R3, so D equals 3. It's a subset of R3, those are the X's, plus R, those are the times. And it concerns the Navier-Stokes equations. So you say that X is in the singular set, so this is the singular set, this is the definition, I should say. S is the singular set of a function of U of XT solving Navier-Stokes. And they have, in fact, in their paper, a particular class of weak solutions of the Navier-Stokes. I don't really have time to discuss that too much, but let me just say the following. This is in the singular set if, for all balls of radius r, I take the ball of radius r about x naught t naught in R4, and we find that u is not in L infinity of that ball. So the vector field just blows up in any, it's a local result, the vector field blows up around any ball. And their theorem, I'll paraphrase it very fast, their theorem, which is that if you take the Hausdorff dimension, Hausdorff dimension 1 of the singular set, remember the singular set is in R4, and that is equal to 0. And then you're supposed to complain, why did I call the Hausdorff dimension, what did I call the Hausdorff measure? So I should say the Hausdorff 1 measure of the singular set is 0. But it's actually a parabolic Hausdorff measure. So in fact, this is a Hausdorff measure, which if here's x, say, and here's t, and here's an evolving, I don't know, this might be s, this is a purported s, that I have to cover it and see what its dimension is. I cover it by parabolic cylinders. So it is, that is, their height is epsilon, but their width is root epsilon. And that goes in the definition of, quote, the diameter of a set covering. In any case, the real Hausdorff dimension, so we just note that the real Hausdorff dimension is less than or equal to some constant than the parabolic Hausdorff dimension in any case. So this implies the real Hausdorff dimension in space-time. So it says there cannot really be threads of singularities passing through. To tell you the truth, this probably governs all the rest of the results which I'm going to talk about. But, okay, it's more technical. Anyway, it's one of my favorite theorems, so I want to leave it up on the board. So that was number one. Number two... This is a P. This is a script P. It's not a very good script P. It says the Hausdorff measure of the singular set, the one-dimensional parabolic Hausdorff measure of the singular set is zero. And the note is that the regular Hausdorff dimension, or any k Hausdorff dimension, is bounded above by the k parabolic Hausdorff dimension, just because you can fit regular size cubes and cubes that are especially fat. It's a constant, right? C is a constant. Okay, so it says that it proves that our normal sense of Hausdorff measure, if anybody has this normal sense of Hausdorff measure, is dominated. It has to also be zero. Anyway, singularities may exist, but they're pretty small. So let me now move to my second result or set of results, which are also from the IDEAS criteria for singularity formation. Excuse me. So what I'd like to do is the well-known criterion for singularity formation has to do with the vorticity. So let me introduce that, which is I'm going to stick again with d equals 3, and I want to take the curl, of course, everyone knows, but I want to take the curl of my vector field u, and that's a vorticity, and it also satisfies an equation. If u satisfies Euler, then the vorticity satisfies d by dt of omega plus u dot grad, so vorticity as advected, plus there's another term. And in fact, in two dimensions, this other term is not present. It changes the character of things quite a bit. If we're in the Navier-Stokes case, d by dt omega plus u dot, you can guess what it is, vorticity as advected. There's that extra term. And there's the viscosity, which, of course, commutes with the curl operation. You can also take do the same operation for Boussinesq, and you can see what comes out. I'm just going to say what happens with the U equation. the vorticity is advected, there's that funny extra term, the what people call the vortex stretching term, although I have to say Euler is reversible, so if it stresses vortices, it also unstretches vortices just equally easily, the viscosity. But of course you have to take the curl of that buoyancy force, so 0 prime theta, which adds some components to the picture. The theorem is first stated, that I want to quote, is first stated in terms of the vorticity. So this is theorem 2. So what I want to do is, let me see how I want to state this. I want to suppose U satisfies Euler. But in fact, their paper addresses Euler. The papers I'm talking about address Euler, but in fact, you can put Navier-Stokes in with no problem. Let's see what I want to say here. Such that U initially is in some HS space. And I think S has to be bigger than or equal to 3. Then there are two results. One, is a paper by Tom Beale, Toshio Kato, and Andy Maida, and it's in 1984 in Communication Math Physics. And they say the following thing. Suppose the interval of time 0t. Well, let's see, I guess what I should say, basic lore says there exists a local solution starting here for either of these equations, and it's a good classical solution. And they say, suppose the interval 0t is maximal such that U stays in HS of 0. Oh, and just make sure that this is not an affectation, at least not this time around. The open parenthesis is real. I don't want to talk about what happens at capital T. That's supposed to be my singularity time. I want every open interval. It's continuous. Such a U is HS 0T. U is a continuous function from that interval into HS. And I guess I also want it to be a once differentiable function from that interval, open interval, into h s minus 1. That's usual. I guess that fits. Suppose it's the maximal interval such then. If t is finite, t could be infinite. You could have a global solution. But if t is finite, then something breaks down, and in particular, something happens to the vorticity. So the interval from 0 to capital T of the L infinity norm of the vorticity, but you take the L infinity norm in space each time, dt equals plus infinity. So the only way to form a singularity is if the vorticity blows up, and not only that, it gives a non-integrable rate of blow up at that. Okay? Second in this list of these theorems is actually raised by a question of that paper, which is a theorem due to Gustavo Pons. And this is 1985, also Communications Math Physics. So what you do is you define the deformation tensor. So dij is partial xi uj plus partial xj ui. And then the first theorem says that the vorticity has to blow up, or controlling the vorticity will control the solution. And Gustavo's paper says controlling the deformation tensor controls the blow up. That is, under the same conditions, the maximal interval such that that is a good Sobolev solution, then if So if t is less than infinity, then integral from 0 to t of dij xt l infinity in the x norm dt is equal to plus infinity. So if you control the deformation, you also control the singularity formation. Okay, these are results from my youth and from the 80s. I'd like to talk about something that's much more recently. In fact, I'm talking about a paper which I received. I think it's not in print. I received the email, I think it was in March, from one of the authors. And I think it's a beautiful result. And it's so simple that I can probably give everything in about half an hour, which is sort of what's left to me in this lecture. So that's result number 3 on squirt singularities. Oh, I forgot to say something over here, which is there are improvements, more recent improvements on this line of reasoning. This is sort of, in some sense, classical PDE reasoning. You prove it for everything or on open sets, you use inequalities, but you can imagine that there's some freedom here. And in particular, I want to cite a paper by D. Che. So he's improved basically 1 to better spaces. So if you put a weaker space here, then it's a better result. So among other things, he has, in order to get, if you are to have a blow up, you can inspect the vorticity, but not in L infinity, but in BMO. And if there is a singularity, this has to equal infinity. And he also has more subtle spaces. But it's a very valid line of reasoning, chipping away at what it takes to make a singularity for Euler, and also Navier-Stokes in some sense tails along as a second cousin in the analysis. So I want to now talk about squirt singularities. So this is I've seen the preprint of Diego Cordova, Charlie Sefferman, and Rafael de la Llave. So the point of view is a little different, which is not to study the entire function space full of incompressible flows, but to study more special situations and to make commentary on them. So often these situations come as follows: that a physicist, an applied mathematician, someone is proposes a mechanism for forming a singularity in a certain setting or a certain regime, and then of course, as is wont, writes papers about it. But in fact, mathematically, under inspection, these can be ruled out. So in fact, that's the line of reasoning of this result. It's a class of purported singularities that in fact can be mathematically ruled out because it's an incompressible flow. So let's what I have to do is start by saying what the definition of a squirt singularity is. So let's do the following thing. We're again studying, I better set d equals 3. No, I guess I don't need that. Let's have d in general. General d. And I want u to be incompressible. So it's the divergence equals 0 equation. And I also would like it to be, and I'm going to inspect this over a time interval 0 to capital T. And so what I want is, I guess, what I want is this. I'm trying to say is that it's a C1 vector field up to, but maybe not including T. And so I guess it has values in RD. That's what it means to be a C1 vector field. And then we have to examine what happens at time capital T. And I've already said that phi, recall that phi is the flow. It's autonomous. It's non-autonomous. So I say if I have to start start and finish are important, both important to the flow. So I start of S and time T of X, this is the flow that tells me where X is transported, starting at S, ending up at time T. And I also want to say, if I put in a set, of the flow, so starting at S and stopping at T of a set propagates the set. So in just in particular, here I have X, and it's taken by the flow to here. This is at time S, and this is time T, and maybe this is the flow sigma. So this is now going to be phi from S to T of that point X. And now this is sigma. Whoops, I better make it thinner because it's supposed to preserve volume. So, and then this is phi starting at S and stopping at T of the set sigma. That's the idea. That's the picture. And then I want to define slightly more complicated thing, which is I want to look at the flow starting at S and stopping at T. Let's just do the following. Starting at 0, stopping at T, of a set sigma, but relative to another set omega. Now that does the following thing. So this is well defined when sigma is inside omega. So what you do, this is equal to, so I'm giving the definition. It's equal to, you look at all the x in omega such that x is, so let me change this a little bit. I'll also change my notes, so I might get confused. So that actually, so all the y in omega such that y is the flow from 0 to t of some x. X, for some x in sigma, so you're taking the flow of sigma. So this is the set of such points. That's what this is, or that's what this is already. However, you rule it out if the orbit goes outside of omega at some point. So with an additional, with the additional criterion that phi starting at 0 and going to S of X stay is always in omega. And this has to be true for all S up to T, maybe not including T. So, right, I need to draw a picture. Maybe the picture can be here. So here's a picture of omega, and that's at time T, and maybe here's another picture of omega. Maybe that's at time 0, and here's sigma. And here's a point y which goes up to x. So this is phi t starting at 0 of y, if this were y. And now that's a point which stays within this set because it never goes outside of omega. But here's a point which doesn't. And here's another point. Which doesn't. Despite the fact that it's still in omega, it left before and then came back. Okay, so these two points are not in. So just want to make the remark that when I take the volume of phi starting at 0 going up to T of sigma relative to omega, suppose that's equal to 0. It means this means that by time t, almost every point of sigma has exited omega at least once. Might have come back, at least it left. Okay, so now I think I'm ready for a definition, which I'm going to put here. maybe unwisely because it was going to get covered. Definition. This is of a squirt singularity. So let's take two omegas, an omega minus B inside, an omega plus open and bounded. And also, I want this to be compactly within, so I want the closure of omega minus to sit inside omega plus as well. And in doing so, that means that the distance from omega minus to omega plus, well, how do I say this? Omega plus, not the distance, but to the omega plus complement. I'm going to make it R, it's a positive number. Then we say the vector field U, the function of x and t, recall, I want it to be once differentiable on the open interval 0 to t, and it's a vector field, has a squirt singularity. This is the word I'm defining. In the set omega naught and omega minus at time t, I want that to be a positive time, when, so I should say it this way, if for all 0 less than t, 0 less than s, less than capital T, there is a sigma sub s lying inside omega minus with positive measure. Sigma S has a positive, you don't have an estimate on the measure, you just want it to have positive measure. Such that limit as T approaches big T, you take the flow starting at sigma S, you start at S and you go up to T, big T, and you only count stuff which goes, you only count stuff if it stays in omega plus, which is bigger than omega minus, if this limit of measure is equal to 0. I think I better draw a picture. So here's my picture of it. Let's make this t equals 0, and then time will evolve, and this is some t equals some intermediate time s, and then this is my final time, t equals capital T. And this is a picture of omega plus, and there's some inside it, some omega minus, and then we have to decide what sigma is. So let's make this sigma 0. And then at later time, there's maybe sigma S. And at later time, there's sigma T, or the limit, as little t gets large, is sigma T. It ejects something. Looks like a squirt. That's what this says to me. Of course, I've left omega fixed, but you can take a given C1 path and translate the whole thing, advect the whole thing in a rigid translation where you advect that point wherever you want. In particular, you could follow one particle path that say C1 all the way up. So you could this definition doesn't have to be fixed, but could be translated along, say, a special path, say y of t is equal to the flow of some why not, which you put in the center of your picture, and then it flows along. And all this other ejection stuff happens in a frame moving with that path. That's okay, too. Well, with all this set up, I better have something to say. So here's theorem. Let's see, that was theorem 1, this is theorem 2, so this is theorem 3, which is, if U has a squirt singularity, so U has to be incompressible vector field, which is C1RD. I never said incompressible here. I guess you can still make the definition, but what's important for us is that it doesn't change the volume. Or it doesn't change volume too much. You could have upper lower bounds on the volume change, but let's keep the doesn't change volume. If U has a squirt singularity in omega minus at time t, then there's an estimate which looks like those criteria for singularity formation. Then the integral from 0 to capital T of not the vorticity, not the deformation tensor, but simply U xt in L infinity dt equals plus infinity. Very straightforward. So it may be there are singularities which are not squirt singularities, but this weaker criterion governs squirt singularities. And stating a theorem, might as well. Well, the adage has it that every talk should have a theorem, should prove a theorem. So let me prove this theorem. Yeah.
A definition, you apply sigma s as a subset of n to the minus for all s, or there is a different sigma s, or how is it reconciled?
Because I made a mistake in doing this a little too fast. Says es is a subset of Rn. But measure of ES intersect omega minus is greater than 0 for all 0 less than or equal to S less than T. That, thank you very much. So there's a set which is being advected. Just as long as it has a little bit less than omega minus each time, and when you hit capital T, almost all of it's out. Sorry, thanks for that. I was racing because the clock, which you don't see, is behind you, and I see it all together too closely. Yeah, you say that. That's right. There's a singularity in omega minus. If there exists an omega plus with a positive distance from it, I guess you do have to massage that definition a little bit. Right. The singularity in omega minus, if there exists an omega plus, that's a positive distance away where everything is ejected from omega plus, from a strictly larger set by the time you reach the time limit.
That's true over all of Rn,
next, L infinity, soup over all Rn, and the soup's inside the integral. Okay? Yes? There's no implication, actually, that there's no implication that sigma s and sigma s prime are related. There's no implication that sigma s is related to sigma s prime. But I've drawn it as though the flow is advecting sigma s's through a family. That's what you should think, but I didn't make them related. It's just a geometric fact, okay? I think. I mean, you could say this is my examination on their paper. So let's prove it, because its proof is about the size of this blackboard. And then let's discuss, and then I want to give you an a priori estimate for the Boussinesq equation. Sorry, for the Navier-Stokes equation. then I wanted to discuss situations. So, proof. Well, for all, you take every s between 0 and t, the points y in sigma s satisfy y of s is in omega minus, and y of t, so you y of t, which is the flow from s up to time t, of y of s, is no longer in omega plus, which is to say that y of t minus y of s is bigger than r. Just because there's a distance between the sets. But of course, I can recover this by saying that's the absolute value of the integral from s to t of the flow of u of y dot, which is given by u of phi of t s y of s, close parenthesis, d dt, dt. So hence the soup, which is bigger than that, and this goes on for a positive measure of such y. So hence the soup over y of u of y of t, and then integrate 0 to t, which is, sorry, s to capital T, which is what we're doing, dt, is bigger than this thing, so it's bigger than r. And now we just remark this. If we had integral from 0 to capital T of this soup, that is, this could be a smaller soup, as someone said, is it a soup over all of Rn? Well, yeah, but you could make it smaller if you wanted more specific cases. The L infinity norm, L infinity in x, dt, were finite, then, well, how can I say? It's like by the by the Lebesgue differentiation theorem, or by some little piece of its proof, then the integral of that function of t has to be absolutely continuous. Therefore, over small intervals, sufficiently small intervals, it has to have sufficiently small integral, in particular, smaller than r. Then, so there must exist epsilon such that the integral from t minus epsilon to t of this thing is less than r upon 2. Contradiction. And you can see it already. Just it has to send some positive measure set arbitrarily fast. So that's easy. Let me now turn to leave that and its proof on the board and just tell you an a priori estimate for the Navier-Stokes equations. Let me make it so I can keep it on the board for a little while. So this is my section 3, which is a priori estimate. So this is theorem 4. So I'm going to make the dimension d equals 3 for this. And I want to let u satisfy the Navier-Stokes equation. And I want it to satisfy it a classical solution in 0 t. I'm going to leave open capital T. I actually am going to keep some tab of the initial data. I want initial data u naught to be h2. Two derivatives of Sobolev space. Point. Then, integral from 0 to capital T, U, I don't say whether there's a singularity or not at capital T. Maybe the vorticity L infinity norm blows up badly there. But U of x t, L infinity norm in x, dt is finite. Conclusion, no squirt singularities for Navier-Stokes. Theorem 4 prime. So theorem 4 prime, same for the Boussinesq equation. With, you also need to have initial data, theta naught in L2, that's all. Then no squirt singularities. Everything is local, so it doesn't matter. There's a good theory on unbounded regions or over a torus, because it's a manifold boundary conditions, you don't have boundary effects like boundary layers.
What do you mean about capital T? What do we say about capital T?
You just don't say anything about capital T. It may be singular, something else blows up there, like the vorticity, but as the vorticity blows up, the L infinity norm of the velocity field does not. Something else blows up. Well, yeah. So you can. So classical solutions exist. Give sufficient data, sufficiently good data. Classical solutions exist for an interval. They fail if something blows up. Those are my regime two. Vorticity or deformation tensor in L infinity blows up are two possible criteria. At those points, the L infinity norm of U has not blown up yet. In fact, something else. Yeah, it hasn't. It hasn't. Point. As long as it's a classical solution, that hasn't happened. Okay? And I contrast that with our criterion, as I've been doing. So, a remark, no such estimate holds for Euler. So I think I'm going to finish. I was going to do two things, but maybe it's a bad sign. I don't know. Maybe it's a good sign. I'm always too ambitious. So I'm going to finish by drawing situations in which there are squirt singularities. And what we're doing is maybe those exist for Euler, but we're ruling them out for Navier-Stokes. Okay? So let me put it in the middle here. So my situation one, so this is in the realm of examples. My situation one is called tube collapse. Singularities. So the picture is always the most compelling. Here's some evolution in time. So here's a picture in space. Evolution of a particle and a little region about it. And now time evolves. So time evolves to my purported capital T, and at capital T, this may happen. Here's that filament. But it may be stretched to the point where it's collapsed along a whole region. Of course, what's happened is the fluid's been forced out. And what I want is these walls to be advected by the flow. What's happened is the fluid's forced out the end. And that's exactly the situation in which there's a squirt singularity. As long as it's not a point in that filament, but a little interval in that filament. That's a squirt singularity. Okay, so that's situation one. View the time, I'm not going to write anything more than that. Such situations actually for Euler and maybe by implication for Navier-Stokes were considered by Chorin. So they don't happen for Navier-Stokes. That's the theorem. Situation two. Situation two are what they called potato chip singularities. Okay, let's keep the word. I was going to put potato with an E in honor of Dan Quayle, but I realize it's not Dan Quayle, it's George Bush who's the president. Sometimes hard to tell the difference. So that goes as follows. I want X to be X prime Xn. I'm going to call those my points in Rn. So the prime means n minus 1 components. And then I want, let's see, I want the situation to look like this. This is a t, and I want this to evolve to t equals capital T. So I want there to be, so I guess I'm saying vertical is xn, and here's the graph of a function f plus, and then here's the graph of a function f minus. So this is xn is equal to f plus of x prime, and the bottom one is xn is equal to f minus of x prime. And then time goes on. And by the time we get to capital T, the following thing happens. Over an entire potato chip, let me try to do this better. There's a region in which those two touch. So let's see, here's the upper set, and here's the lower set. But they go up to this, and they meet at this point. And they meet, See how that goes? Does that seem right? They've stuck together right in the center. Not a brilliant picture. But so let me say it again. And then I'm going to say f plus or minus of x prime and t are equal to f on the flow. Maybe it's easier to say the following thing. This is some surface s plus and some surface sigma s. I need a name. M plus and M minus, and these are you flow, but from time T to time capital T of M plus, and you flow from time T to capital T of M minus, and they stay a graph, and they smack together over an open set. I can write that down, but I'm run out of time. And that is a singularity, which of course ejects fluid from here. And the fluid is, in fact, ejected with horizontal velocity. So even a better criterion says, in this case, U prime, that is a horizontal velocity in L infinity, integral up to T dt, is equal to plus infinity from the same argument. Here you could say the vertical velocity only has infinite. Okay? Those are two situations which are ruled out. And I'm going to finish with Moffat's question. So this actually is D equals 2. And his question was for the Boussinesq equations in D equals 2. And the level sets of theta are somehow indicators of flow lines. So the situation he drew was something like this. That here's a situation at t equals 0, say, which then evolves as t goes up to capital T to the following situation. Or this point at x to this point, the aspect ratio of the hyperbolic point has collapsed. So one way to say it is that the level sets of theta foliate space. So that says you look at rho, and as rho changes values, you get different leaves, and it looks essentially like a quadratic form, which is hyperbolic. So it has a a beta t y1, so I guess x1 plus x2 times gamma t x1 plus x2. And to make it hyperbolic, I'll have beta t and gamma t both positive, and I want them to be continuous. On 0 t, I don't say anything about what happens at time capital T. And then the saddle collapse, so a saddle collapse when you take the limb in as T goes up to capital T of well of beta and of gamma. So since they're both positive, both non-negative, I'll have beta T plus gamma. We'll control them both. That equals zero. That's the situation where the saddle collapses. And of course, any time before the saddle collapses, there's still a little reason of positive measure, although the measure is getting small, but it's still positive measure, near the origin. And as it just collapses, it has to be squirted out. And so, and I never really said precisely what Keith Moffitt's problem was, but his 21st century problem was to understand the character of saddle collapse. And so this paper of Diego Cordoba, Charlie Pfefferman, and Rafael de la Llave among other conclusions, is saddle collapse does not happen for the Boussinesq equations. I'll stop here. Over T, if anyone presses me, I will prove theorem 4. I was planning to do it, but ran out of time, so thanks very much.